Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is India. With me to discuss the future of U.S.-India relations is Tanvi Madan. Tanvi is a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies program at the Brookings Institution, where she directs the India Project. Her research focuses on India's foreign policy, particularly its relations with China and the United States. She is the author of the recently released book, Fateful Triangle, How China Shaped U.S.-India Relations During the Cold War. Tanvi, thanks for joining me.
Good to be on the podcast, Jim.
Now, I want to preface our conversation by noting just before we sat down that a glacial flood in northern India created a great deal of destruction, killing at last count more than a dozen people with another 125 or more people missing. So our hearts go out to people in that situation. I want to sort of broaden the conversation out, Tanvi, just to begin talking a little bit about sort of how the world is seen from India. I should say how the world is seen from New Delhi. And I know, obviously, in a country with more than 1 billion people, there are many different perspectives. So I guess this is mostly a question about how does the government of Prime Minister Modi see the world and India's place in it?
I think much like the situation here, his primary focus is domestic, what's going on at home, where he's grappling with a trifecta of crises, the economic crisis that kind of preceded COVID, but that health crisis, which is the second one, has exacerbated the situation. And then the third crisis, which is the national security crisis, the ongoing China-India boundary conflict. And so I think he's seeing the kind of world primarily through the lens, first and foremost, what is the world doing to these challenges? How can it be helpful? Where can I mitigate harm? And so, for example, he will be relatively pleased in many ways to see a Biden administration that is a little more consistent. Or a lot more consistent. While India did well, relatively well, with the Trump administration in certain realms, it was a very high maintenance, volatile relationship. And so I think given that the US has become, if not the most important partner for India, one of its most important partners, I think they will see a kind of administration in the US coming in that is consistent and less volatile as a good thing. I think the situation with China is still a serious situation. The Chinese are still sitting on territory they did not sit on before last May. They have not moved back. Talks, as far as we know, don't seem to be going anywhere.
Tommy, let's stop you right there. Maybe what we should do is sort of step back and if you could paint for people a picture of what has happened between China and India that has sort of made this issue come front and center for India. Because obviously, India and China share a border. They fought a war back in 1962. There's a longer history there. But maybe if you could sort of help us understand that standoff. That'd be great.
In May last year, what emerged, that's May 2020, what emerged was news that India had said that China had unilaterally changed the status quo at multiple points at their what's called the line of actual control, which is an undemarcated boundary between the two countries. It's the line that separates the two forces. There's an area of land, that territory that I like to call both man's land, which is a territory that both claim neither quite hold. They each patrol the area. They often transgress, as in they cross the line, but they don't. Anytime you, what you're not supposed to do, according to the agreements they have, is establish a permanent presence or hinder the other side's patrols. And India accused China of changing the status quo unilaterally and by force. What made this crisis more serious than the ones that have come since Xi Jinping took office, this is the fourth such crisis, boundary crisis, is that this was happening at multiple locations, much more aggressive, much larger deployment of troops on both sides, because India then responded to what they call the Chinese first move. But more significantly, what we saw in June was fatalities at the border, where we still don't know why it happened or what exactly happened, but there was a fatal clash for the first time in 45 years. And that's what made this difference. Since then, we've also had another threshold crossed, which is shots fired at the border. That's where things stand. The two sides are still facing off in forward deployed positions across the line of actual control and across their border. border more broadly. And so this leads to a somewhat kind of a sensitive situation where you never know when escalation might happen. There's a going to be a point of kind of concern once the temperatures rise and the snows melt in the mountains, where we might see this arise again in the next few months. So this is still not, this is not a dormant situation. It's something worth watching. What it has done, though, is it's had broader ramifications than just a border skirmish, because the Indians have essentially said China has violated the agreements we've signed. Those agreements were the basis for a broader set of Sino-Indian engagements. And as long as boundary situation isn't resolved, you can't get back to normal in the relationship.
I want to get to those broader ramifications, Tommy, but maybe you can just sort of spell out for us what exactly it is that India and China are arguing about in the mountains. Obviously, we do not have an established border, and people often wonder, well, why is it hard to establish a border? And they think, well, there must be some resources they're fighting over, whether it's minerals or oil and gas or what have you. Now, of course, this line of actual control is high up in the mountains. Is it about material resources, or is this simply that neither side wants to be seen as giving up on something it or its people think belong to it?
So some of these areas are uninhabited, hard to reach. And so this is a question that's often asked, you know, why it's what's asked about the South China Sea, right? Why are we fighting over rocks? And I think in some ways it's about the principle and the agreements, because if you're doing it there, where else are you going to do it? What the Indians are concerned about today, you will do it in these inaccessible areas. Tomorrow, what does this say about your sticking to the rules-based order, the agreements we've signed in other parts of the border that are more populated, for instance? There's also the point that some of these areas are quite strategic. And so particularly this area called Depsang, we haven't heard much about it. This is not where that kind of fatal clash took place. It's north of that. But if China, for example, establishes a presence there, that is where it can link up with the Pakistani military in a more significant way. And so when Indian war planners have to think about a potential two-front war with China and Pakistan being quasi-allies, the question is, you know, they have to, if they lose that territory, they lose access to it, or even if China just has a more kind of established presence there, does it start to threaten, for example, India's northernmost base at a place called Daulat Begaldi? Yes, you know, some people say, is this about status? I think it's less so about that. It's less so about kind of symbolism. It is about perceptions, at least, of territory that is significant and strategic.
So let's talk, Tanvi, about the consequences for Sino-Indian relations. I will note that India's external minister said late last month that essentially relations with China are now at a crossroads. So perhaps you could map out for us what Delhi thought it was working on with China up until the events of the last several months, and where you think India may be going in light of the events of the last several months.
One of the things that India and China did after they had a pretty major kind of boundary crisis, which lasted for months in 1986-87, after that, they took a series of steps to try this first stabilized relationship and then lay the groundwork for engagement. And so between 1993 and 2013, we saw them sign a series of agreements that basically laid out how you manage the dispute and potentially resolve it, including dialogue mechanisms, kind of protocols of the kind that actually don't exist between India and Pakistan. And so these agreements helped stabilize that aspect. It helped, as they said, say, maintain peace and tranquility at the boundary. And what that did was it allowed them to explore engagement. So you, in between kind of 2000, the next kind of 15, even 20 years, what you saw is higher level bilateral engagement, almost kind of annual summits between the leaders. You saw economic ties go from pretty much zero to China becoming India's largest trade partners if you just consider trade in goods. You also saw kind of collaboration, more connectivity in kind of the academic space and the research space. You'd started to see Chinese companies invest in India's tech sector in a big way. And you saw India and China cooperate in some global governance issues, whether that was climate change or trade, and in the setting up of, you know, plurilaterals like the BRICS with Russia, Brazil, and South Africa. But also India, for example, is a founding member of and the second largest shareholder of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. There's a Russia-India-China trilateral. So you did see a whole kind of series of areas where they were cooperating with each other diplomatically, economically, etc. But what has essentially happened is those areas, at least for now, you've hit a pause button on that. The Chinese government's line is that, you know, the boundary issue is the boundary issue. Let's not let whatever scuffles we had there bleed out into the broader relationship. India takes exactly the opposite view, saying our broader relationship and all that engagement was based on sticking to those agreements, and now that you violated them, what does that say about your commitment? And so what you've seen is not just a hardening of the Indian government's views or the public perception, but actually policy measures that either restrict or impose extra scrutiny on Chinese activities and investments in a range of regions, whether that is economic, whether that's the tech space, whether that's telecommunications, but even things like university exchanges.
So I have to ask you, Tombi, picking up on the notion that in recent years, Sino-Indian economic relations have increased. Has India been a big beneficiary of the Belt and Road Initiative? It's often talked about, usually in terms of China's trying to develop its economic relationship with Pakistan, talk about a route that would give China an outlet on the Arabian Sea. How does India view the whole Belt and Road Initiative?
India was one of the first major countries to come out in opposition to the Belt and Road Initiative. In fact, quite unusually for India, which tends to be quite cautious about statements about other countries' initiatives. When the first Belt and Road Forum was held in 2017, India's foreign ministry put out a public statement that listed why they were not going to participate in the summit. And they said essentially that they saw the Belt and Road Initiative as a unilateral national project that wasn't taking into account it was more supply driven than demand driven. It wasn't taking care of environmental sustainability, fiscal prudence, was adding to governance challenges, and also something that was more specific to India, that it didn't respect territorial integrity. And the reason India put that in is they object to certain projects that are part of the China-Pakistan economic corridor that are in parts of Kashmir that India claims and Pakistan holds. And so you've seen India essentially say that Belt and Road, the initiative itself is problematic, as opposed to the AIIB, for instance, that I mentioned, which the rules were developed by consensus. They complain about BRI's lack of transparency. What is left unsaid is another concern, though, that India has, that China, through the Belt and Road Initiative and its economic activities in India's neighborhood more broadly, is gaining strategic influence, political influence, and is starting to shape the choices that these countries make, both in China's favor, but also essentially encouraging them to cross India's red lines or ignore them or limit their interactions with India, Japan, or the US for that matter.
So let's talk about the third leg of the triangle, to borrow on the title of your book, Fateful Triangle, How China Shaped US-India Relations During the Cold War. How is Delhi's thinking about the United States being changed, if it is at all, by what's happening in terms of its relationships with China?
I think it's a significant driver of the relationship with the US. So I think going back, in fact, to even the end of the Clinton administration, but particularly since the Bush administration, you've seen a Delhi that is across their governments, so BJP and Congress-led governments, see the US partly as important because it can serve as a balancer to China. That they don't want to see, the way they put it is, they do not want to see a unipolar Asia, and they alone cannot ensure that that comes to pass. And so they're working with a network of partners. The US is probably first amongst equals there to ensure that there's a favorable balance of power in Asia. But the US also helps India by not just being an external balancer, it helps internal balancing to help build India's military capabilities, to help with India's economic resources. And so you see India seeing the US as the US is having convergence with India on some concerns about China's rise per se, but particularly its behavior and uncertain intentions. And so this has been a key driver for the US-India partnership over the last few years. And you can see in the last few years, in 2017 and 2020, there have been these major boundary crises between India and China. And those have led to particularly the deepening of defense and security cooperation between India and the US, not just bilaterally, but India, of course, doubling down on its commitment to the quadrilateral, the Australia, India, Japan, US quadrilateral. So it has made a difference. India has some questions about the US's approach to China, but broadly it has driven the two countries, the US and India, together.
Well, I take your point, Tanvi, about US interest in India, in involving it in its strategy of countering belligerent or aggressive Chinese behavior. And I'll note that the United States has rechristened its Pacific strategy an Indo-Pacific strategy. I think that's obviously a nod to Delhi. But looking at that, how broad or deep is the consensus within India about the wisdom of getting closer to the United States, partly because all countries like to preserve their freedom of maneuver, their autonomy. But also, there's a history here over the last half century, 75 years. Again, you know very well, during the Cold War, India was a non-aligned country, but its major benefactor was the Soviet Union. India's main concern was about Pakistan, whose main benefactor was the United States. U.S.-Indian relations were often, how should we say, frosty. So sort of thinking about how Indians more broadly think about relations with the United States, how comfortable are they with this idea of working more closely with Washington?
I think they're more comfortable than they used to be. And part of it is, for the discomfort, is the history you mentioned. One of the things my book tries to do is actually say that our understanding of that history needs kind of a revision, because at least in the first half, so for the first about 20 years of the Cold War, you did see India and the US actually collaborate exactly on China, but that kind of fell apart. The history of that relationship, of that triangle, kind of has left a legacy. So where there is consensus is that the US and India share a certain degree of convergence on perceptions of China and many aspects of where their approaches overlap. There's also some amount of consensus, or at least if not consensus, a dominant view that working together with the US is a good thing. The differences come on two fronts, at least. One is on approach, and the second is on perception. So let me tackle the perception first. There is a kind of concern dating back to the 1971 India-Pakistan War, which coincided with the U.S.-China rapprochement in July-August 71. There is this concern in India about a G2, a U.S.-China condominium. And there's concern in Delhi, including among serious people, this is not a fringe concern, that because the U.S. has so many different imperatives with China, has interests with China, wants to cooperate with and all things like climate change, that tomorrow it will actually, you know, dial back its competition with China. And there'll be kind of a spheres of influence world where the US and China, you know, will divvy up the world and India's interests will fall to the wayside. So there's that concern that, you know, what is the kind of US actual perception of China? There's also some concern, I think this was more with the Trump administration, India doesn't see this as much of an ideological challenge. It's more geopolitical and geoeconomic. I think a set of concerns are around approach. What is the best way to tackle and compete with China, and how far to go with the US? So you'll have, I think the major difference where you'll find is how far to go with the US in the Indian debate. The current government has gone further, and this has been progressive. Each Indian government has gone further with the US than the previous one. But whoever's in opposition complains that it's going too far and is going to kind of infringe on Indian strategic autonomy. So I think that is the biggest kind of subject to debate, because this comes from two sides. One is just the America skeptics. Look, the US is an unreliable country, or, you know, even Trump showed it was very uncertain, shouldn't depend on them. But then there's also a series of some of India's China hands who say, look, if we get close to the US, China will press us even more. That has, I think, lost some traction, because you've seen countries around Asia, they've held back with their relationship with the US, and they've still kind of been at the receiving end of coercion or assertiveness. So I think those are the contours of the differences you see on the subject of how close to get to the US.
Now, just before we sat down to tape the podcast, we learned that Prime Minister Modi and President Biden had a phone call. We don't have a benefit of the readout of that phone call. I assume there were a lot of diplomatic niceties in terms of praising each other and looking forward to future cooperation. But I'm just curious, Tanvi, from your vantage point, what do you think Delhi most wants from the United States? You've already mentioned talk about help in terms of defense and building up the military and the like. But is there sort of a broader vision from Delhi's perspective of how this relationship might evolve?
I think it goes back to what I started with. I think they want to see a U.S. administration that can help India's objectives on particularly the national security and the economic side. And I think you will see, for instance, that play out in the sense of understanding that what they need to do is also show how India can be helpful to a Biden administration that similarly needs, you know, has talked about burden sharing, has talked about working with others, but also has a lot of domestic priorities. And so I think what you'll see is a Modi government that will say, let's rebalance. Relationship doesn't need repair, you need rebalancing. So not just continue with defense and security cooperation in international institutions to ensure rules-based order the Indo-Pacific. Hint, hint, let's agree on China. But you'll also see, I think, an emphasis on things like climate change, global health security, with India kind of one of the largest producers of vaccines in the world and already distributing them to other countries. And I think you'll see other areas like, you know, the digital trade or economy more broadly, and maybe higher education, where they want to see the US help India's goals, because these are all mutually beneficial in some ways. But I think you'll also see a Modi government that will want to see a Biden administration that figures out its trade policy, because there's a mini trade deal. But, you know, if actually the Biden administration does what the Modi government is doing, which is talking about a lot of reshoring rather than diversification, that becomes problematic from the trade, investment, and immigration point of view. So I think they want to see where the trade approach is going for the Biden administration. I think they want to see a Biden administration that understands that while it sees Russia as an adversary, that India still has defense ties with Russia that it doesn't want to give up on and has legacy ties. And then finally, I will say, I think the Modi government will want to see the Biden administration not say very much to it on issued questions of values. So, you know, what India insists are its internal affairs, but a Biden administration who said that values and democracy and liberalism will be part of their agenda.
Let's pick up that thread, because obviously in any conversation, even with close friends, there are issues of contention, disagreement. And I think it's pretty easy to lay out some of the major areas of disagreement between the United States and India. You've already noted there are significant trade differences. The Trump administration was quite critical of Modi for making it difficult to sell American products there. I think President Trump had ambitions to greatly grow that trade. It doesn't appear to have done so. But let's talk a little bit about the issue of human rights, because there have been protests recently in India by farmers who are opposed to certain policies of the government they believe are going to hurt or ruin their livelihood. The governor, Prime Minister Modi, has cracked down. People have been arrested. Rihanna, who I believe is a pop star, tweeted about it. And this has created another hullabaloo. So can you sort of walk us through, you know, partly what's happening in India and why the Modi government is reacting the way it is, and can a Biden administration really just not say anything?
The farmers' protests and the response to it are a little more complicated than some of the previous protests we've seen. The farm laws, there were three farm laws that were kind of introduced and passed in India that actually many in the West would have approved of, because it is liberalizing the agricultural market in a way that many countries in the West, and particularly the US, has actually called for many years. So I think the laws themselves, now there's a big debate in India about, you know, whether or not they'll have the benefits, whether they'll kind of diversify the agricultural economy in a way that was supposed to. But regardless, I think on the principle of agricultural market liberalization and farm reform, these are things that the US has generally been supportive of. I think the complication has been in the initial reaction, the criticism about the way the Modi government went about introducing these laws, but also dealing with criticism of them is where the criticism has come in. And I think you've seen some of these protests, but also governments and senators and members of Congress react. And that's over first that these farm laws were, there wasn't much consultation, there wasn't much of a parliamentary debate about them. Then the other kind of thing that the Modi government did that I wonder if they would have done in hindsight, which is their overreaction, and particularly kind of a crackdown to the initial protests. There were peaceful protests the farmers were engaging in, who were objecting to this rule, and they did push back quite hard. They were trying to stop them from coming into New Delhi to protest. Subsequently, since what you saw on January 26th, was this turn, these protests turned violent. A small group of farmers, or we actually don't know how many, actually did themselves kind of go off and agreed to protest route, engage in violence themselves. We still don't know whether the cops kind of reacted. Regardless, these protests turned violent. And then the Indian government cracked down more significantly. Again, you haven't seen the kind of level of pushback from the Indian police that you saw in previous protests. But I think what the US, and you saw the Biden administration, this goes to just to say a couple of final things. You saw the Biden administration put out a statement that tried to balance these different goals, which is on the one hand say, look, we do support the idea of ag market liberalization, but also point out that things that the Modi government did, for example, internet shutdowns to ensure that you didn't see these protesters kind of, you know, communicate with each other or tweet on social media, or kind of things like, you know, arresting journalists, or detaining journalists covering the stories, or putting pressure on social media companies to block accounts and and American social media companies. Those are the kind of things that fellow democracies should not engage in. And so I think they threaded this needle where they expressed their concern about things like internet shutdowns, access to information, while saying it is the right of people in democracies to protest, without making a kind of a blaming one side or the other for the violence that ensued on the 26th of January, because I think it's still kind of blurry what exactly happened. So I think the Indian government will have to understand that the Biden administration will not stay silent. I think the Biden administration will have to understand that there are limits to what they can achieve without kind of, you know, with statements. But I think that, you know, what they will probably do is what the Obama administration did, which is more kind of frank discussions privately while making some statements publicly to show where they're concerned and where they understand these are domestic policy decisions that India will have to make.
Let's talk about another issue that can often be a sore spot in U.S.-Indian relations, and that's Pakistan, which is obviously a country that shares a border with India. The two have gone to war. Both are nuclear powers. The United States, for quite a long time, an arms supplier to Pakistan, an ally of sorts, though I think relations between Washington and Islamabad have been, how should we say, tense in recent years. How do you see that issue unfolding in the years to come? Does Prime Minister Modi have an ask to make from Joe Biden about U.S. support, relations, conversations with Islamabad?
I think there are two aspects here. One will be, I think, the where you could see asks or at least discussions. One is related directly to Pakistan. The Modi government will want to see the Biden administration keep the pressure on Pakistan to go after terrorist groups, and not just ones that are targeting, you know, kind of American or ISAF troops more broadly in Afghanistan, but also those that are targeting Indian facilities and citizens. So I think that aspect, which is whether through direct pressure or through the financial action task force, where the U.S. has put a fair amount of pressure along with other countries on trying to get Pakistan to crack down, you're going to see, and this obviously has been in the news with the release of the people convicted of killing Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street Journal reporter, and you saw a pretty strong statement from the Biden administration about that. I think the second area where Pakistan would fit in is in the context of developments in the situation in Afghanistan. And India watches that situation quite carefully and closely. Prime Minister Modi is going to have a conversation, a virtual summit with President Ghani. Part of what they will discuss, I suspect, is what the Biden administration's approach to the kind of peace process, the reconciliation, political reconciliation might be. And so what India will be concerned about is that what will Pakistan ask for and what will the U.S. be willing to provide for Pakistan's role, either midwiving or kind of ensuring the enforcement of or continued buy-in to this, these conversations in terms of the peace and reconciliation process, or at least the peace process.
Tavdi, I'm curious, what is your sense of how much influence Washington has in Islamabad? Because again, one argument for the United States to exercise influence in Pakistan is that it will work, that it can buoy, lift up, protect, to the extent possible, democratic processes in Pakistan. And the other argument is, at the end of the day, the United States is going to break its lance on Pakistan. And so extending it good offices, extending it benefits, simply doesn't pay off. And the only way to approach it is with a really tough line. And of course, the counter argument is, you do that, you're going to drive Pakistan and China closer together, and that would be a major geostrategic loss. You know how these scenarios get spun out. But how do you assess it? What advice would you give to the Biden administration?
It's a fluid situation, partly because this answer always has to factor in that if you think about who Pakistan's major external partners have been, they have tended to be China first and foremost, and Pakistan's going to maintain that relationship. It is going to be a quasi-alliance, whatever the U.S. does. I think that has to be, it's not going to push it into Chinese arms further. It is in Chinese arms. China is in Pakistan's arms. So I think it is a close relationship that has to be recognized. But I think there also are other kind of relationships that have been important to Pakistan. One is obviously the U.S. relationship, but a third set has been the relationship it has with its Gulf patrons, the Saudis and the UAE. And what's been interesting over the last few years is you could see a Pakistan that is finding itself increasingly with only China and perhaps to some extent Russia, but not really. Russia is kind of a friend, China as a quasi-ally, but its relationship with the U.S. has deteriorated. And the Saudis and the Emiratis, because they are actually increasingly interested in strategic, but also economic terms and energy terms in India, have been less reliable for Pakistan than perhaps they were in the past. So I think where the US kind of leverages is the fact that if you're Pakistan, you actually want multiple patrons so that you can play them off against each other. You don't necessarily have an interest in, for instance, being stuck with and left with China, because China then will make demands of you that you can't say, you know, I'm going to move towards the US if you don't have a US option. That leverage is there. I think the US can also do a fair amount of, we always think about what the US can do in terms of carrots, but there are a lot of sticks that the US holds. And so you could see the US saying, look, if you do X, Y, and Z, or Z, as the case may be.
You are allowed to say Z. I can say Himalaya or Himalaya. You
there
can say
you
Z.
Go. Then we will not come down with punitive aspects on this other thing you're doing. So I think the US probably does continue to have leverage, but I think, you know, there is this question of how do you engage? So a relationship with the US with Pakistan that's more broad-based doesn't have to be about, yes, let's only do things with the military, which is what has been the tendency historically, which is the US has seen the military, for understandable reasons, as its primary interlocutor. And the problem with that is, then again, the answers often give us more military aid, etc. The answer should be is have kind of a broader based relationship, much like with China, though, without giving up the kind of pressure of you have to act. There are certain red lines on what Pakistan does with the Taliban or with terrorist groups that it can't cross. So I think the US has leverage. It's probably more and less than some people assume. I think the reluctance has often been in the US is not so much that the US hasn't had leverage with Pakistan, is the question of, you know, whether to use it or not at that particular time. So I think it's not that leverage is missing. It's just a question of calibrating it and working with other countries so that the US is not the only country out there telling Pakistan to do certain things.
On that incisive and insightful note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Tanvi Madan, Senior Fellow in the Foreign Policy Program and Director of the India Project at the Brookings Institution. She is the author of the recently released book, Fateful Triangle, How China Shaped U.S.-India Relations During the Cold War. Tanvi, delight to talk to you. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Jim.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick. Zoe was also our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.